While we're waiting, Mr. Triggs, can you confirm that you can see the tile with the time on it?
Yes, I can, John.
And you can see and hear us. Okay, great.
I can, thank you.
Is it Mr. Ellenbecker? Are you able to see the tile?
I actually am having a problem here. Oh, there I go. Okay. I can now see the tile, yes.
Great. And are you able to turn your video on? Okay, great. All right. So we're going to start right away because we have this issue with our time. And I will just note that this is the second case on our Zoom oral argument calendar for March 6, 2025. This is A240855, State of Minnesota, versus Ryan Stephen Masog. I apologize if I pronounced that wrong. I'm Kayala Eid. I'm presiding judge today. I'm joined by Judge Harris and Judge Smith. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes for your argument. When you begin your argument, please state your name and who you represent. And there's no other recording that's to be made of this. There will be an audio recording on our website within about a day. With that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is John Ellenbecker. I please the court. I represent Ryan Masog, the appellant in this matter. Mr. Masog was charged with two counts of interfering with privacy, convicted of those two counts. We had also made a motion to dismiss for lack of probable cause that the trial court denied. The statute, the portion of the statute that we are concerned with, makes it a crime to surreptitiously gaze, stare, or peep in the window. And the applicable portion of the statute was where a person would have an expectation of privacy. And I apologize here, I'm having trouble with my Zoom again. I can't. Don't know what's going on here. There we go. The portion of the statute and what was really at issue, and is the issue in this appeal, is whether appellant's actions were surreptitious. The statute doesn't define, and nowhere could we find a definition of surreptitiously within Minnesota statutes. The trial court then defined it as unauthorized and secret, hidden or concealed, done by stealth and without legitimate authority. The circumstances here involved Mr. Masog, who owned a home. It was a duplex. He had converted into a single family home that he had converted into a duplex. He lived in the upper level. He rented out the lower level. The lower level had multiple bedrooms. He advertised it for lease. The tenant, who was the subject of this matter,
Can you hear me?
applied.
Are you able to hear me? Sorry to interrupt. I just want to make sure you didn't disagree. Well, at least there was no objection to the definition of surreptitiously that was given in the jury instructions. And it doesn't, and I, and am I right that you're not disagreeing with that on appeal?
That is correct. In fact, I agreed with it at the time. I don't think I can appeal. So the tenant initially was rejected by appellant for issues that were found in her background check. She managed to convince the appellant to allow her to lease the apartment based primarily on her mother co-signing the lease. There's two dates representing the two separate counts where incidents were supposed to have occurred. On the first one, appellant early evening is going to run an errand. The state has conveniently put a copy of state's of Exhibit 2, Trial Exhibit 2, on page 9 of their brief, which is a photocopy of the or a photograph of the residence. He goes to his car, and you can see the car in the photograph where the evidence was he normally would park the vehicle. As he's doing so, he notices a light on in the living room, but nobody present in the living room. The car is parked adjacent to the living room. He then goes around to see what he can see. Now, I should have prefaced this by saying, and I apologize, Pellant has very conservative religious beliefs, and those religious beliefs include a prohibition on sex outside of marriage. And
Mr. Ellenbecker, I just want to interrupt because I think we've read the briefs and know the facts of the case. Do you agree that the tenant had an expectation of privacy in their bedroom?
I think there is a diminished expectation of privacy when a person is in a lower level of a residential unit, has been offered curtains, doesn't use those curtains, put up a blanket to cover the window, has taken the blanket down, and the window is adjacent, immediately adjacent to the front door of the residence. So, what are your expectations of privacy? The tenant testified that she understood that she had a reduced level or expectation of privacy in that bedroom with nothing covering the windows because she wouldn't change in the bedroom. She used the bathroom instead. So her own testimony was of a reduced expectation of privacy in that room.
Wouldn't that reduced expectation of privacy involve inadvertent sightings or inadvertent the ability to look in inadvertently as opposed to deliberately?
Well, that's what you're going to decide, Your Honor.
Okay.
I would argue that if the landlord is in a position where he is legally authorized to be, and he is not doing anything surreptitiously, that anything that he sees is not a crime. And I think the issue is less about an expectation of privacy and more to do about whether Pellant's actions were surreptitious, as defined by the judge, by the trial judge.
But
So,
your client, oh, go ahead, Judge Smith.
go ahead. I'll defer to you.
Didn't your client admit in his interview with the investigator that at least what he observed in the first incident was private? He said, that he understands why they would be uncomfortable, why the tenant would be uncomfortable with that because what she was doing was private.
I believe the record was that he understood why she might feel that it was private, but he actually didn't see anything. And that is kind of underlying all of this. In either instance, he didn't see anything. He saw the light on in the living room, no light on in the bedroom in the first instance. He walked where he is perfectly legal to be, around to the front. He's standing by the deck at the front door. The state wants to characterize this as crouching and hiding and looking around the pillar. Well, the pillar is a 4x4 holding up this small deck. You aren't hiding anything if you're standing by that
He didn't
deck.
knock on the door and ask her if she was having premarital sex, right? And he
He
didn't let
didn't.
her know that he was looking in the window until after the fact, right?
Right, but he didn't see anything when he did that. He came
Is
up,
that
looked in.
an element of the crime? I mean, is the state only allowed to prosecute interference with privacy when someone actually observes someone doing something private?
No, but your actions still have to be surreptitious. And that's, he isn't being surreptitious. He's standing by the front door to his residence, open and obvious. He's not crouching. He's not trying to hide. There isn't anything to hide behind. And moves on. He goes, gets in his car, and when he gets in his car, he makes an observation. That observation is clearly not prohibited. He's in his car at the end of his driveway at that point. So he hasn't done anything at this point to be surreptitious.
Do you agree that with regard to the determination of whether or not there's sufficient evidence to support whether your client acted surreptitiously, that we apply the direct evidence standard to that determination?
Yes.
Okay, so then we would construe all of the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, right?
Correct.
So, how are we to conclude that this wasn't surreptitious? In the way that it was defined by the district court and under the Black's Law definition of unauthorized and clandestine, when your client did so at night, and did not let her know that he was looking in at the time he did it. Why was that not unauthorized and clandestine or done by stealth and without legitimate authority?
Well, first, it's a de novo review, so it's incumbent upon you to review the evidence.
Well, the
Don't
de
be.
novo applies to the definition of surreptitiously, right? Not
Yes,
the direct evidence standard.
but you still have to apply it against the facts of the case, and in this case, there was nothing to indicate that he was secret, hidden, or concealed. No evidence to support any of that. The definition then continued on, done by stealth. There was no evidence to suggest it was done by stealth and without legitimate authority. The state's argument is that because he didn't do anything to make himself obvious, that he therefore intended to hide himself. But that isn't consistent with the facts. He did nothing to hide himself. He's standing out in his front yard in a neighborhood where he has every right to be. He's not secreting himself. He's not hidden. He isn't concealed. And he isn't doing it by stealth. Second incident is even more clear. All he does is walk around 8 or 6 to 10 feet around the house. It's all he did. And none of that would suggest that he was secreting himself, hidden or concealed, or done by stealth. I'm sorry, but the facts simply don't support the conclusion beyond a reasonable doubt that he was acting in that manner.
Was there anything in the lease that allowed him to inspect the property for illicit or for premarital sex?
Okay. The record would be I mean, that wasn't developed in the record at trial, but what was developed was that the tenant had a clear understanding that because of appellant's conservative religious beliefs, she was not allowed to have sex outside of marriage in the apartment. So she had a clear understanding that that was prohibited. So I can't tell you there's anything in the record that would suggest that he had any authority to do anything beyond or anything as you suggested to investigate.
Did he not admit that the purpose of his trying to look into the window was to see if he was having premarital sex?
That's kind of a misinterpretation, I think, of the exchange between the prosecutor and the appellant. The prosecutor asked if he walked to the front of the house by the deck to see what was going on inside, and the response was to yes, investigate if the lease is being broken. And then the question was to see if they were having sex.
Mr.
Oops.
Ellen, I think you froze.
Intent to see if there was sex going on, but he was looking to see if the lease was being violated, and that's what he contended all along.
But there was nothing in the lease that technically prohibit her from having sex. It was just his feeling, right?
That is correct. It was an inartfully constructed lease by him. He thought he was doing it by prohibiting any member of the opposite sex after 10 p.m. But again, the record was clear. The victim testified that it was clearly her understanding that she could not have premarital sex, that it would violate the lease if she did so.
So, counsel, didn't both of these events occur before 10 p.m.? If so, then what lease violation was he proposedly, or that what he was investigating? If I guess I'll end with that. What lease violation was he investigating if both of these instances occurred before 10 p.m. and at least my guess is that she would be allowed to have individuals of the opposite sex in her home before 10 p.m.
Right. And the record is that they both occurred before 10 p.m. The lease prohibited after 10 p.m. But also, this was in the context of the understanding that the two of them had that she was not allowed to have sex outside of marriage in the apartment. So this isn't about a lease violation. It's about whether he is engaged in peeping by going to see whether she is having sex outside of marriage in the apartment, in violation of their common understanding of their lease agreement.
Just one other thing about How close was he to the window? I understood like 4 feet.
The record would be, I believe the testimony of appellant was he was 4 to 5 feet away. You can see where the deck to the entrance to the residence is relative to the window. He was standing next to the deck. The boyfriend, who is the only other source of information as to his location, said he briefly saw a shadow that was 4 or 5 feet away.
Thank you.
My time is about up. I guess I would entertain any additional questions. I think I have said about everything I need to say. I would just emphasize that the record simply doesn't support that appellant did anything to hide his presence on either occasion, and that the state's argument that because he didn't make himself obvious, that the only intent you could, or the only conclusion you can reach is that he intended not to be seen, simply isn't a common sense conclusion. I mean, he didn't do anything to hide himself, and that's what the statute prohibits. He has to hide himself. He has to do something to conceal himself, and he did not do anything to do that. Absent any additional questions, I would reserve the balance.
Seeing no other questions, thank you, Mr. Ellenbecker, or Mr. Triggs, whenever you're ready.
Please, the court, the counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Kyle Triggs. I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, and I'm here to ask this court to affirm Mr. Maysog's convictions for counts 1 and 2. Personal privacy is something that we, as all reasonable people, expect in our own bedrooms. The victim in this case paid for that right. She was a tenant who kept up on her rent. She had a right to expect to be free from other people going up to close to her bedroom windows and spying on her. Mr. Maysog was found guilty because the evidence showed he did not respect that right. He went up to the windows, and by his own admission, with the intent to investigate probably one of the most personal aspects of somebody's life, her sexual activity. He did this at night without warning from up close. This is exactly what the criminal statute prohibits. It prohibits someone from surreptitiously gazing into someone's window where someone has a reasonable expectation of privacy, where a reasonable person would expect privacy. In an area where they could be exposing intimate parts or clothing covering the intimate parts. Your Honor's already read my brief. I'm not going to repeat things for the sake of repeating things. What I was going to start with is addressing the very specific arguments that Mr. Ellenbecker brought to the court today. He had first, I believe, argued that because the victim did not have curtains on her bedroom window, that there was, I think he used the phrase, diminished expectation of privacy. And my response to that, Your Honor, is that while certainly if someone does not have curtains in their bedroom, they may need to be cognizant of what someone could inadvertently see from far away, someone walking down the street or someone driving up the driveway. But the lack of curtains is not an invitation for someone to walk right up to her window and look into the room from that close. And we're talking about the distances, according to the boyfriend, of 4 to 5 feet. That's not normal behavior. In fact, I believe on cross-examination, when Mr. Maysog himself took the stand and tried to make the argument that he would not, that his office does not have curtains and that people could probably see what he was doing, the prosecutor had asked him, "Isn't there a difference between that and when someone walks right up to your window?" And he acknowledged it. That's what this case is all about. It's not about the expectation of privacy for what people from far away could inadvertently see. We're talking about the freedom from having someone walk right up to that window with the intention of looking inside, which is a big difference. She had the right not to have her privacy violated in that way.
On the
Mr.
intention point, is it the state's position that Mr. Maysog's testimony that he didn't intend to interfere with their privacy, but only intended to investigate whether or not there was a lease violation? So, on this sufficiency analysis for intent, first, do you agree that the circumstantial evidence standard of review would apply to that? And second, if so, is it the state's position that that statement that he intended to investigate a lease violation is part of the circumstances proved, or is what is the state's position on how we should analyze that at the first step of that test, if you agree it applies?
Your Honor, I would argue that, I mean, there is a mix of direct evidence and circumstantial evidence in this case. And I would say that even if we're looking at this from the circumstantial evidence standard, we take every statement at trial that favors the verdict as true. And that would bring me to that exchange he had with the prosecutor that Mr. Ellenbecker commented on, where he said he was asked, was it your intent to see if she was having sex when you're looking through a window? And he said that would be a violation, at least correct. He's saying correct to the question of you were intending to see whether or not she's having sex. We take that as true because that favors the finding that his intent is to see something that reasonable people would deem to be private. I mean, a person's sex life is arguably one of the most private things you have. So, I mean, even under the circumstantial evidence standard, that would be taken as true and would support the verdict. If that makes sense, Your Honor.
Well, I mean, so is it this, even if that would be a violation of the lease, and I understand there's evidence in the record about that being an oral agreement between the victim and Mr. Maysog, is it mutually exclusive that he may be intending to investigate a violation of the lease and that he be interfering with their privacy in doing so?
I would argue that it's even if it's a lease provision, the intention to violate her privacy is still there because the definition of intent is not just limited to wanting a result, but believing, knowingly engaging the conduct that produces the result. He is knowingly putting himself in a position to watch something that he knows is private. And I would submit, Your Honor, that he had acknowledged to the police ultimately, even though he had made arguments about her room not having curtains, he ultimately says, yes, that's her bedroom. She has an expectation of privacy there. So he is knowingly looking into her bedroom from up close, an area where there's privacy. And so he's knowingly doing something that interferes with the privacy. It's the same thing as intent under the law. And I, on the topic of the fact that this lease provision, even if we take as true that they verbally modified the lease by adding the prohibition against premarital sex, this does not excuse him from having to comply with the criminal statutes. There is nothing in that lease provision that put her on notice that he would be monitoring her. There was nothing in the lease provision that put her on notice that he would be walking right up to her windows without warning and looking in. There was. And in fact, the one lease provision that talks about his right to inspect the property, to any extent we consider that provision requires 24 hours advance notice, precisely so that her privacy can be respected, so that she can be made aware if there's going to be observation into her room. And so it's the lease provisions does not help the defendant one bit in terms of excusing him from criminal liability for what he did. Moving on to another argument that Mr. Ellenbecker made, he had made the argument that because Mr. Maysog owns the property and that because he was standing on an area of his property outside the house, that if he had the right to be there couldn't be a violation. Your Honor, this is not about trespassing. He wasn't convicted of trespassing or burglary. This was about the conduct of peeping. It's that he walked up to a room where someone would reasonably expect privacy, and he intentionally gazed through the window surreptitiously. That's the issue. So the fact that he owned the property does not help him. I would use the analogy if someone owns a house and they have a guest over, and the guest uses the bathroom and they watch them through a hole drilled into the door, that's a violation. I mean, even if they own the house and have the right to stand where they're standing, it's about the gazing. It's about the surreptitious spying that this statute's about.
If he had knocked on the door, I know these aren't our facts, but if he'd knocked on the door or knocked on the window when he did it, would that be sufficient evidence on the element of it being a surreptitious act?
I think if he is first gazing without warning and he then later knocked, I believe he would still be guilty, Your Honor. Because I think that what matters is that He is doing this without her knowledge, without advanced knowledge that he could be doing this. I think that makes the difference. And on the topic of surreptitious, I think Mr. Ellenbecker had made the argument that, well, he did not adequately hide himself. I would submit, Your Honor, that during his testimony, he had also said, I did not do anything to make myself obvious. And not only that, we also have the testimony from the boyfriend who was with the victim that night when they were being intimate. And he's describing the shadowy figure, who we established was Mr. Masog himself. And he described the physical conduct of the shadowy figure, how it kind of creeped in toward and away from the window, peeked around the post, and how it vanished very fast. I mean, this is conduct consistent with someone who's trying to avoid being seen. So we can consider that evidence as well. And I think we can take one step further. We have to remember that when Mr. Masog spoke with law enforcement, with respect to the first incident, he had denied approaching the window. He had told law enforcement that the only reason he observed what he appeared to be consistent with sexual activity was him backing out of the driveway and somehow positioning his car in a way where the rear lights illuminated the window and showed the boyfriend without a shirt on. We reject that version, but it's the fact that he then at trial admitted to, oh, yes, okay, I did approach the window after all. I mean, that to me is telling. His consciousness of guilt, the decision to withhold that information from law enforcement. Especially when Mr. Masog does this after he sees the boyfriend testify that he could see a shadowy figure. And so I think that only strengthens the state's case even more. And then what we can also consider for the surreptitious.
Does that go to both the surreptitious element and the intent, do you think, the denial?
Absolutely. Because it has to do with him trying to catch them in the act. He had made it clear when he got into an argument with the victim's mother through their text exchange. She had told him nothing warrants you peeping through her windows. And he made the comment, get real, as in, of course, I'm not just going to ask her. I don't expect her to be honest. I mean, this was all about investigating her sexual activity and trying to catch her. I mean, that speaks to the secretive nature and to your honor's point. The intent to violate her privacy. This is the kind of conduct he knows is otherwise private to her. She would not expect people to be going up to her window, which is why he's doing this without advance warning. I mean, that's the evidence makes that clear. I think there was one factual clarification I also want to make, Your Honor. When Mr. Ellenbecker was referring to the second incident, unless I misheard him, he had mentioned Mr. Masog being 10 feet from the window. If I recall correctly, I believe Mr. Masog had testified that he was 6 feet from the window, which is cl obviously closer than 10 feet, but I wanted to draw that clarification. Those are the issues I wanted to address, Your Honor. Unless anyone else has any questions, I guess I would conclude by saying this. I mean, this we are talking about the bed someone's bedroom, one of the most private areas of the home. And what Mr. Masog had admitted was that he was investigating a very, very personal aspect of somebody's life, you know, who someone decides to be intimate with and when. I mean, that is a deeply private matter. I mean, this could not be a greater illustration of a privacy violation, Your Honor. Without curtains, yes, this could change what people would inadvertently see, but we're not dealing with an inadvertent sighting. We're dealing with deliberate monitoring. We're dealing with Mr. Masog doing what reasonable people don't expect their tenants to do, which is walking right up to the windows at night without warning and peering in from that close. That does cross the line. And that is why I'm asking this court to affirm the convictions in this case. So unless any of your honors have further questions, I would end it here.
Judge Smith? Oh, no. Okay. Not seeing any other questions. Thank you, Mr. Triggs. Mr. Ellenbecker?
Thank you, Your Honor. To clarify, I may have said 8 to 10 feet for that second incident. The transcript at volume 2, pages 58 to 61, indicated 6 to 10 feet, just to clarify that. The arguments and the court's questions have all centered on this issue of privacy. And privacy is only one aspect of the prohibition here. I'm not here to argue that she didn't have an expectation of privacy in her bedroom, although I would argue that it was a reduced expectation of privacy, but rather, the central focus of this is whether Mr. Macek's actions were done surreptitiously. Now, on the first instance,
Let me ask you just to direct on the surreptitious point. We didn't talk about in your initial argument the text exchange with the mother of the victim. And so, under a direct evidence standard of review, why doesn't the fact that he essentially, Mr. Maysog essentially tells the mother of the victim, "Yes, I was trying to catch her in the act because I wasn't going to believe her if I asked her." That as your counterpoint argued in response, why doesn't that tell us completely that he was intending to observe her without her knowing, because he is basically saying, "I don't expect to be told the truth if I inquire or I do an inspection." So why doesn't that support the evidence, sufficient evidence of on surreptitiousness?
because it doesn't describe what he actually did. In fact, within a day of his having this instance where all he sees is a shirtless male rise up into the window, he goes and speaks to the tenant. It wasn't as though he was trying to hide this. He wanted to be able to ensure that she wasn't engaging in activity that he felt she was prohibited from engaging in. So he
How
was
does
going
what
to
he
discuss
does
it with her.
after the fact, in terms of telling her no, to the hypothetical I posed about knocking on the window, after he's already looked, Mr. Triggs argued if he's already looking in the window and then knocks, or if he looks and then tells her a day later, when he tells the mom, "The reason why I went up without letting her know is I wasn't going to believe her," why isn't that sufficient evidence that he was intending to try to catch her in the
Well,
act? He not to know he was there.
I think it's how you characterize this. I think the characterization that he was trying to catch her is, I mean, he was trying to determine what was whether she was in violation. Was he hoping that she was in violation? I don't think the evidence supports that. I think the evidence supported that he was trying to make sure she wasn't violating the lease. It wouldn't make sense for him to go up and knock on the window when he looked in the window and didn't see anything. That's the state of the evidence that you have. He didn't see anything, so he walked away. That's the evidence. And then he talks to her a couple of days later, where she admits that they were having sex. And rather than evicting her, he takes her at her word that it's not going to happen again, and he allows her to continue on. So is he trying the second time to see if she's violating? There, again, it's a little the circumstances are a little suspect. Only light on is in the bedroom. There's no one in the bedroom. So he circles around the house 8 to 10 feet, not hiding himself, doing nothing surreptitiously to see what's going on. And then he sees nothing, confronts her again a couple of days later, and says, "This just isn't working. It's time for you to move." So it's clear that he wasn't trying to catch someone. I did make a point about this wasn't some prurient interest on his part. He wasn't trying to catch someone having sex for the titillation of seeing somebody having sex. He's just wanting to make sure that his lease isn't being violated. And that's what he's doing. Open, above ground, above board. He isn't hiding himself. He isn't sneaking around the yard. He's doing it out in the open. And that is not surreptitious.
But that's not what the jury found, was it?
Well, you have to read between the lines. I mean, they found that he was guilty. So I guess they found it was
But
surreptitious.
weren't they the determiners of whether it was surreptitious or not?
Well,
Under the definition that everybody agreed to?
and my point, though, is that the evidence doesn't support that conclusion.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ellenbecker. Thank you, Mr. Triggs, for helpful arguments today. The matter is submitted. We'll issue an opinion in the statutory time frame. That concludes the second matter on our oral argument calendar today. For those of you that are with us and here for the third matter, I'm going to ask everyone to please log off and then log back on the Zoom because we're having an issue where each Zoom is being limited to 40 minutes. So if we log back on, we'll have enough time for the full argument without interruption. Apologies for this technical difficulty, but if you could please log off and then log back on. Thank you.